You're listening to the ModernDogTrainer.net podcast, bringing you the best industry tips and topics for professional dog trainers worldwide.
Hi there. You're listening to the Modern Dog Trainer podcast. I'm Ines McNeil, founder of the Modern Dog Trainer blog, and today I'm chatting with Kat Camplin, my co-host, and Alex Andes. And before we get started, I wanted to let you know that we're giving away a hard copy of The Human Half of Dog Training by Risa Van Fleet to one of the next 5 reviews on iTunes. Simply search for The Modern Dog Trainer in the Apple Podcast app, add your review, take a screenshot, and email it to me at themoderndogtrainer@gmail.com. The drawing will take place as soon as we have 5 new reviews that have been posted.
Don't forget to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at Modern Trainer and on Facebook. All the links are in the show notes at themoderndogtrainer.net. So put your feet up, grab something to drink, and let's get started.
Awesome. So welcome, Alex. Start out by telling us a little bit about yourself?
So I've been training dogs for about 9 years. I got my start in the shelter world. So I was in college at UGA studying something completely different, studying journalism.
Oh, wow.
And I started volunteering at the shelter in Athens, where UGA is. And I was realizing how many dogs were being euthanized due to what I felt like must be treatable behavior problems. A lot of resource guarding issues. Just general poor manners. And so that kind of got my wheels turning, and I got really invested and involved in that whole world. It's like the mafia. Once you get in, you can't get out. So it was an interesting 4 years there. And actually my sophomore year, I met Victoria Stillwell at a book signing that she was doing in Athens. And she and I just hit it off right away. We probably held up the line for 30 minutes at the book signing, just talking dogs. And so we exchanged contact information, and she hooked me up with some really great, a couple of her VSPDT trainers. So I did a little bit of assistant work with them before I went on with Victoria about a year after I graduated. So I worked with her for about 5 years before I started my business, Peach on a Leash, which is a dog training business in Atlanta, just north of Atlanta, Georgia. So I've been doing the business about 9 months now. It was a total leap of faith, but it has been more than I could have ever expected. So that's been really wonderful. I recently took the CPDT KA exam, so I'm hoping to have that under my belt, should have those results back soon. And then I'm also enrolled in the Gene Donaldson Academy for dog trainers to really refine my training skills. So a lot of it right now. So that's a little bit about me.
Yeah. So what did you do for Victoria Stillwell?
So a little bit of everything. It's kind of a jack of all trades for her. We did a lot of web series together. We worked with arson dogs and with police dogs, teaching people about how do those dogs, how are they trained? How can we improve the way that they're trained? I did all of her social media and marketing. We traveled together all over the world and did seminars and just got to learn from her in so many different aspects of training and behavior, and not just the dogs, but really working with people. Because anybody that's ever met Victoria can tell you that she is exceptional, not just with dogs, but with people. And so I was able to learn so much about the human side of training as well as the dog side of training with her. So that's a little bit. We also did, she's got a dog training academy. So I helped her with that. So just a little bit of everything. And she and I are still very close. She was in my wedding last month. So she's still one of my best friends.
Awesome. And what made you want to go out on your own and, you know, start your own business?
You know, it always kind of had been my end goal and my dream. And it was so hard to leave what felt like a dream job. But at the same time, I felt this calling to help people, to help dogs one-on-one in their homes, really doing what we did a lot of talking about with Victoria. I was ready to really go in and work in home. And just, it's like once you have that little feeling, it's, you just can't ignore it. So I was finally ready to take the leap.
Awesome. And how did you become involved with animal shelters as a dog trainer, and kind of why did you decide to pursue that while you were starting your business?
So like I said, I really got started in the shelter world, and I always kind of felt this allegiance to shelter dogs and wanting to help them. So it was just one of those things that just felt natural, that just because I have this business doesn't mean I want to stop helping the dogs that don't have homes, that really need the extra help. So I got involved with Atlanta Boxer Rescue and Angels Among Us Pet Rescue, which are two foster-based groups. So I do training with them, but then the big thing is I'm now the training partner for Fur Kids, which is the largest no-kill shelter in the Atlanta area. So we've got about 65 dogs in the shelter at one time, and then there's a whole other group of dogs in foster. So it's a lot of dogs to manage at one time. It's one of those things that when you've got that passion for it, you just want to be able to apply the training that you have to help those dogs.
That's great. So, you know, I'm in LA, so there's like, you know, 101,001 rescues and animal shelters. Yes. And all that fun stuff. So how do you vet which sort of rescue organization or shelter you want to get involved with? And what would you recommend others look for when they're looking to do some volunteer or partner with a shelter or a rescue organization?
That's a really good question, because there are so many rescue groups, some of them very legitimate, some not so legitimate. So I recommend absolutely meeting with the management in person before you make any kind of agreement. Have a written agreement in advance with everything that your expectations are, what you kind of want. Everything that you are hoping for from your end, so that you can balance your expectations with theirs. Because a lot of times what they think and want are doable in terms of just a weekly training partnership, it might not be. You'll be amazed at how much time management you actually have to do when you're running a business and also trying to work with a shelter. There's just not a lot of free time to work with. So making sure that you set those boundaries in advance. And meeting with the management, you should look for really an openness to change. Some shelters still have this mindset of, well, this is how we've always done it. This is what we've always done. So even if it's maybe not the best way, this is just the way that it's been. And so you either come in and you fit this mold, or it's just not going to work. You want a shelter that says, hey, we need help, and we're willing to learn and listen. And you need to be willing to learn and listen as well, because you're going to learn things about how that operation runs as you get in there and start working with the staff. So you also want staff and management that are really open to learning and really want to help the animals. Sometimes, you know, there's places where the staff, just for better or for worse, that's just not their main priority. They're just kind of there to do their time and get out. But if you find a really wonderful shelter, they're going to be willing and able to help the dogs as much as they possibly can.
Absolutely. And I know one of the challenges I've seen is, you know, obviously anybody off the street can call themselves a dog trainer. So what did you share with them, or how did you establish yourself as a professional and really, you know, a credentialed dog trainer that they should work with?
So we met in person. I discussed my qualifications with them, explained to them, you know, you don't have to choose me for this. If you do choose someone else, this is what you should look for. So giving them those things, you know, look for these qualifications, look for these credentials, look for this education. So I think going in it with this approach that you want to help them, whether or not it's you, that's okay. But let me help you make sure that you make a good decision. So I think that if you come in this sort of desperate attitude of like, I'm the best, I know everything, none of us do. Let's be honest. There's always learning to be done. So just giving them the option of, hey, you don't have to pick me, but regardless of who you choose, these are what you need to be looking for. So I think if you kind of go in with that attitude, people will have a lot more respect for you.
For sure.
Awesome. What kind of learning goals did you set? I mean, there's such an awesome, amazing ability to work with every kind of animal that you could ever possibly encounter in a home. But also the human aspect, what did you sort of expect to learn from shelters? And did you learn something that you didn't expect?
I mean, I think that there's learning that happens every day. We do a lot of meetings and learning opportunities with the shelter staff. I think that's probably more important than any training that you can do with the dogs, because I'm not there every day. I can't be there every day. So they're the ones that are working with the dogs more than anybody. So I think that they have been amazing to work with, because they're very upfront and honest about, hey, this is what's going on. These are the issues. This is what we've experienced with these dogs. And so having the respect for them to say, hey, you guys are the ones that are really putting the hard work in, and being there for them and everything that they need, just being a support system, really is helpful for the staff, because sometimes it can feel very isolating and overwhelming, and they feel like they're the only ones that have to deal with what are sometimes very difficult dogs.
Right. Awesome. And with the animal shelter, you said you kind of set expectations ahead of time. What were those expectations? What were you kind of clear about at the beginning?
So I think that the most important thing I set was I can't work a set amount of hours every week. It's going to vary each week. Some weeks it's going to be more, some it's going to be less. So there's that expectation that you're not going to see me every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I'm going to be there at the time that I can be there. I have to prioritize my own needs first. That's the easiest way to not burn out, I've found, is that as hard as it is to not try to help everyone and put everyone before yourself, you have to make that free time for yourself. So what I'll usually do is I'll carve out my schedule in advance. I'll look at, you know, what my availability, what my free days are, what time do I need for me for an off day, a legitimate off day, or at least a paperwork catching up off day, and what days do I also, am I able to get to the shelter? When is that a possibility? So just setting those time restrictions, I think, was probably the biggest thing. But also explaining, you know, this is what I can and can't do. I'm not going to be able to work miracles with extremely aggressive dogs that have been here for 3 years with not being here full time. So trying to also manage those expectations of what can we accomplish through training? What can we accomplish through management and enrichment? And really trying to set those guidelines in advance, because there is, I think, this sort of pervasive myth that training just fixes everything. And as we all know, there's some dogs that training isn't what's going to make things better. And it's really about management. It's really about getting them into a better environment. So trying to make it clear in advance that this is what I can do, this is what I can't do. If this is okay with you, this is how we'll do it. If it's not okay with you, then here are a couple other great people you can talk to. So trying again to make sure that I don't present myself as this all-powerful, you know, trainer that can just come in and fix everything, being there once or twice a week. It just isn't realistic.
Right. And you mentioned you work with a lot of foster organizations. How do you kind of get them all on board and keep the same training kind of throughout the whole?
Right. Well, with the fosters, with really any of the organizations, we'll do the training in their home, because that's usually where the issues are happening. You can do anything you want in the shelter, and then they get back to the foster home, it's still the same problem happening there.
Right.
So working in the foster home, and then I write a written training plan that kind of covers in a client-friendly way what we have gone over, why we're doing it, what the goal is, so that they can track their progress. And I always really encourage people to take notes or take a journal, especially if they have a fearful or aggressive dog. So that they're able to see that progress and those little progressions that happen over time. So I think with the foster homes, the biggest thing is support and consistency with them. So feeling like, you know, you can't just go in, have a session. All right, thanks, bye. I mean, it has to be an ongoing support system between the foster and between the trainer so that they're able to really follow through on that. Because we can accomplish so much more in the foster homes. With a shelter, it's really about keeping the dogs as stress-free as possible, really reinforcing good behaviors, trying to prevent bad behaviors from happening. But in the foster home is where we can really have behavior modification happen.
Right.
So for the more difficult dogs, what we try to do at Fur Kids is to get them out of the shelter ASAP. If they're struggling there, get them into a foster home and then work a training plan from there.
Awesome. And how do you prevent volunteering, whether it's for an animal shelter or with the fosters, from kind of taking over your time?
Still a work in progress. digress. It's a fine line. And like I said before, I feel like you really have to prioritize your own needs, and especially the needs of your business, because you can't neglect that. I mean, that's really the primary driving force that allows you to be able to work with shelter dogs, is having that business. So I think that you have to accept that, you know, things aren't going to be perfect. You're not going to be able to get there as every time you want. You're not going to be able to fix everything. But you know, you have to just be able to walk that line. It's a challenge. And I definitely recommend that people really get their business in order. They get organized. They make sure they have software that they really like for scheduling and for client notes and things like that before you try to add on what can't, like, it can be a huge time suck. But you really, if you set those boundaries in advance and you make sure people understand, this is not my full-time job, I'm not going to be here every day, I can't be here every day. If you need a full-time trainer, that's what you need to bring in, because you're really more consulting than anything else. And you know, you work hands-on as much as you can, but it's more than anything working with the staff, making sure that they're able to follow through consistently on what you're doing.
Absolutely. And then how do you turn, you know, from volunteering your time at the animal shelter with the fosters to generating new clients for your business?
So there's a couple of things that I've done that have worked well. I've got some marketing materials that go into all of the adoption packets, and the adoption counselors will also talk them through it and say, hey, this is our trainer. If you have questions, this is how you can reach her. She's available for, you know, private training and all that. And I do offer a discount on my group classes for adopters. It's a great way to fill your group classes and also make good connections with people that have just adopted. So I've found that that tends to work really well. They also refer to me. So if they get just random people that will call in saying, hey, do you have a trainer you recommend? People call all the time. And then also adopters will call and just ask for those referrals. So having the shelter refer to you is really, it could be a good thing. One thing I would caution against, I do not do free training for adopters at all. I have found that if people aren't paying for their services, they're not quite as invested in the training for the most part, and there are absolute exceptions. But I think that if a shelter says, hey, you're having trouble, why don't we send in our trainer? It's just not quite the same as when you have a client that's really invested and really wants to work through it. So I just don't do free work for adopters. With the fosters, I work with them in their home and also at the shelter. But in terms of adopters specifically, I don't do anything. I do the discount classes, and that's about it for the adopters. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. So what kind of education do you think people should have before approaching a shelter to, you know, work with them or partner with them?
Yeah, I think that you've got to have a lot of experience working with a lot of different types of dogs. You've got to keep your breed biases in check if you have any, because you're going to run into every possible breed of dog that you could imagine in a shelter. And they're not always the easiest dogs to work with. One of the things that we've done that has been really helpful is we've brought on a really wonderful intake instructor who I work closely with, and bringing in dogs that can handle the shelter environment. You've got to be so selective about the dogs that come in when you have a kennel environment. It's very different than just going into a foster home. So that has been something that has been really helpful, bringing him on. So I think that is helpful for bringing in the right dogs. But even if you bring in the right dog, I mean, you're still going to get so many different types of dogs. So making sure that you've got hands-on experience, and also that you understand just the principles of learning theory, that you've gone through at least a course that gets you through the fundamental principles of training, that's important. So I think you're going to have both. You have to have the science-based learning, and you also have to have that practical application. And I also think that it's great to volunteer at a shelter if you're kind of new in the training space and you're just kind of getting your feet wet. Especially if you have a more experienced trainer that you can work with, that you can learn from, I think it can be really valuable. And even just doing basic training with the dogs is huge for enrichment at the shelter. I mean, 5, 10 minutes of training and they go back and pass out in their kennel. I mean, it doesn't take much. So it's a really, I think you can have both, but if you're going to really go all in as a training partner, you've got to be able to offer them a true understanding of behavior and what you're doing and why you're doing it. Be able to write a training plan, be able to see from start to finish what you're kind of going to be working with and how you plan to do it. If you go in blind, it just never goes the way that you want it to. So having that plan, even if you defer from the plan, at least having that in place before you try to go in and present yourself as, hey, you know, I'm worth your time and energy and money to bring in as a trainer, because there's just so much. There's so many people that have, that, as we all know, don't have the qualifications to be training. Right. And a lot of them do end up working with rescues, and they use really harsh methods with dogs that have already been through so much. It pains me to see some of the things that rescues allow trainers to do to their dogs. It's a problem. It's a big problem. And so if you're a quality trainer and you've done the science, you've done the hands-on, I think you owe it to the shelter dogs to be their advocate, because if you don't do it, I promise you somebody else will, and they might not use the same humane methods.
Right. And just to go back a little bit, I really like that you differentiated between being kind of just a shelter volunteer and, you know, learning the ropes and getting that hands-on experience versus being an actual training partner with the rescue or the organization.
It's very different. It's one thing to go in, work with the dogs every day, which is so important and so needed, but it's another thing to really be working hands-on with the staff, working with intakes, working with the foster homes, making sure that everybody is on the same page, working enrichment. That's been a big thing, is enrichment and making sure that those dogs aren't just sitting in their kennels all day, because right. that's the quickest way to having just a bunch of miserable dogs that are so crazy when other dogs walk by. So we try to do everything we can to kind of minimize that.
Absolutely.
So what kind of programs, you know, I mean, enrichment I think is great. There's a movement towards play groups and stuff. So what kind of classes or programs are at the top of your list to implement? And I guess this follow-up to that question is there pushback from shelters or rescue groups to implementing those things?
I think that it depends on the group that you work with in terms of the pushback. The groups that I work with have all been very forward-thinking, and they want those things for their dogs because they see the changes that happen when the dogs are getting training and enrichment. It's just a big difference in the overall energy level of the kennel. So there's a bunch of programs that we've implemented, some more successful than others. One thing that we've done, we call it the champion program. So each staff member and some volunteers have a dog that they're kind of assigned to. And so they market the dog, they come in, they work with the dog. We have goals for each of those dogs and what we'd like the people to be working on with them. So that's been really helpful. We've actually gotten a couple of the more difficult dogs adopted, I think in part because of that, which has been really nice.
Nice.
We haven't really implemented this yet, but there's a couple of groups in this area that do, they call it Dog for a Day, I think. So the dogs go with a volunteer for the day. They go out and about, they go get some enrichment, get out of the shelter for a day or even overnight. I believe they did a study recently, don't quote me on this, but that the overall stress levels of dogs, the shelter dogs, just one night out of the shelter, when they retested those hormone levels the next day, they were much, much lower. So just even a night out of the shelter can be huge for these dogs. Aww. So trying to enrich them as much as possible. I even just a day out, you see a huge difference, just at least for the next couple of days, that they kind of got that mental stimulation that they don't always get at the shelter. We have treat buckets in all of, we try to keep them on all of the dogs, kind of feel like little miniature metal buckets. So we put treats in there. The dogs need to sit when people walk by, or if they're just reactive at their kennel, we don't require anything. We just have people throw a treat in as they go by. But for the dogs that are just maybe a little bit louder, we'll just ask the people, say, hey, ask for a sit. Or in some cases, once they learn it, you really don't have to ask for it. They'll offer it. So that's been helpful for especially the dogs that are reactive to people coming by rather than barking, they're kind of more expectant, like, oh, here comes a person, what do they have for me? So that's been helpful, and it's very inexpensive. You can get little miniature toy kind of buckets online really cheap. So that's where we got our buckets. We do regular staff training and volunteer training. So we go over just everything. We answer questions that they might have, but then we also kind of have different themes. So body language, handling, how do you not get bitten? In some cases, and we had a dog that had recurrent ear infections that weren't really discovered until it was kind of too late and he was starting to bite. So that was a dog that had already kind of learned that biting worked. Mm-hmm. So even after the ear infection cleared up, it was still an issue. So we started working with him with the targeting stick, and rather than having to grab the collar, having to put a leash over the collar, the target stick helped the staff to be able to maneuver him without having to reach those hands in. So teaching them just easy skills like that, that are really fun and rewarding for them, is really helpful. And so I try to keep the meetings fun, hands-on. They go on for hours and hours. It's more of they get to ask questions and be involved. And I think that's a lot more fun and rewarding for them than just sitting and listening to a PowerPoint for 2 hours.
Yeah, totally.
And then enrichment has been huge. So we have a ton of Kongs that have been donated and other similar kind of toys. So for the dogs that like peanut butter, we do peanut butter. We're adding some other different types of, we want to kind of rotate so it's not always the same. So using some like chicken broth, some canned pumpkin, Greek yogurt, stuff like that, that we can kind of rotate out. So that's been really helpful. We try to have set times for that. So the dogs are getting to be on a good schedule. So it's not just sort of a random, it's really, you know, they get outside in the morning. We have a training time where the staff actually gets to work hands-on with the dogs. It's built into their schedule. We have a time for enrichment where they're passing out Kongs at least once or twice a day. So that has been really helpful in just giving them something to do, because I think that just sitting there all day, it's such a recipe for disaster.
And quick question about the staff. Do you find that they enjoy that time to spend training?
Oh my gosh, yes. They absolutely love it. It's like, and they've said before, you know, we were worried to do it before because we were worried people would think we weren't working.
Right.
So that we had to kind of address that's probably more important than anything else you do, yeah, is really getting even just 5-10 minutes per dog goes such a long way. And I think they really enjoy, even in the morning you do training, let them rest, let them, you know, go throughout the day, go back in the afternoon to work with that same dog and see the push forward progress just right in a day. I think that is rewarding in and of itself without them maybe even realizing it. So getting to see that progress, I think, is really enjoyable for them.
Yeah, because it's, you know, working in a shelter or kennel environment is hard on staff as well as the dogs. So
absolutely.
It's great.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to switch gears. So any last words about that? Awesome. I do want to switch gears. I want to know a little bit more about how the Victoria Stillwell Academy works. Can you tell us?
Absolutely. So the Academy, they have US and UK based programs now. So they've got both East and West Coast in the US, and I believe one or two different locations in the UK. So the program is partially online learning and it's partially in person. So everybody that goes through that academy gets to learn directly from Victoria, and in person, working hands-on with her with dogs. They have live dogs at all of their intensives, which I think is so important. You know, the learning component online is important, but I think it's also critical to work with dogs hands-on and have just instant feedback from really great faculty. So what I love about the program is that they don't just cover training. They also cover marketing. They cover human communication, which is, if you've been training for, you know, a few days even, you'll know that the human side is probably the most difficult part, and certainly the part that a lot of people struggle with. Everybody loves dogs and wants to help dogs, but I think it's so important that you go in wanting to help people as well. You go in just caring about the dogs, you're not going to really succeed. I think you have to really want to help people, and you have to be empathetic to people and say, you know, I know that you're struggling with this. I want to help you. And it has to be about the person and the dog. So I love that they kind of cover both of those things. So the Academy, I believe it's 6 months from start to finish. And they've got a great, once you graduate, you'll be listed on their search function as a, you know, VSA graduate. And then after, I believe it's 2 years of training, you'll be eligible to be a VSPDT or apply to be a VSPDT. So they do require that you've got at least 2 years of hands-on professional dog training before you go to that next level of being a Victoria Stillwell professional dog trainer. So it's a really good start, especially for people that are just getting off the ground. Maybe you're not confident, or you're worried, you know, where do I start? I love dogs. I kind of know about training, but I want to really put it into something functional. I absolutely have loved working with the program. They do an amazing job.
Awesome. Perfect. All right. Well, if somebody wants to follow up with you and reach out to you, how can they get in touch?
So you can follow me on Facebook. It's Peach on a Leash Dog Training and Behavior Services. You can find me there. I'm always active there. You can always email me. It's info@peachonaleash.com. Those are normally the two easiest ways to reach me. My website is peachonaleash.com, so you can check me out there as well.
That's such a cute name. How'd you come up with that name?
Thank you. I knew I wanted something with peach in it because we're in Georgia, and I thought it was so cute. And so my husband and I were going back and forth with something with peach in it, and he was just cooking at the stove, and he turns over his shoulder, and he's like, Peach on a Leash? And I was like, that's it. That's the name. I love it. It sort of rhymes. Right. It's fun. So it was just the second I heard it, I knew that that's what I wanted to go with.
Awesome. So funny. All right. Well, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you all for having me.
Do you love the podcast? Looking for more to grow your dog training business? Check out our website at themoderndogtrainer.net to learn more from our blog, join our Facebook group, or take a course. Ross Malcolm Boyd edits the program, but he does a lot more than that. Visit rossmalcolmboyd.com for rainbow unicorns, online music lessons, and more.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Dog Trainer podcast. Don't forget, you can check out the show notes at themoderndogtrainer.net/podcast. You can also share your thoughts and support our podcast by leaving a review on iTunes. Until next time.